So are there any questions on the Greek law that we did last time before we go on to Irish law? Speak quickly or not. All right. Irish law is, I think, really quite fun. I don't know how much you people read, and if you read anything more than the assignment, and I think having just reread some stuff, I probably ought to expand my chapter even more than I did in the last pass, because there's more interesting stuff I didn't include. Are there things or questions that struck you reading either my chapter or the reading from the book? Yes.
Maybe you can elaborate on why it was that women were given so few rights, yet if they had land, it gave them almost an equal footing to cancel their husband's contract. How could they own land if they weren't?
Well, that's an interesting question. They can't inherit land in a permanent sense. That is to say, if a man has only a daughter, his daughter basically holds the land, I think, for her lifetime, or maybe till she has an adult son or something, but it isn't fully hers. But as far as I can tell, there would be nothing. Suppose I'm a man and I have some land which is not kin land. All right, that one of the things, we don't have any way, I think, of measuring the amounts, but it's clear that a lot of the farming land is land held by the Dyrbthin, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but by the four-generation kin group. And that land, at any given time, is held by individual members of that. It's divided up among them, but it then, somehow or other, is getting redivided or reallocated, maybe each generation, that's not entirely clear, but basically, it's considered to belong to the whole group. But in addition to that, you can earn money either by farming your kin land, or if you're a blacksmith or a poet or a physician or something. So you can get you can have wealth that the kin has no claim to or has a limited claim to. And I think the rule is that if you got the money from your profession, you can buy land, and a third of that is added to kin land, and two-thirds is yours free. So presumably that two-thirds you could give to your daughter or give to anybody else. So I guess the answer is, now it may be that they're thinking about the case where she's temporarily inherited, so to speak, but they could also be considering a case where she actually owns the land because it was transferred to her. And as far as I can tell, women can own things. I think that's right. So I guess that's what's going on. Now again, one of the things you can't tell is that on paper the system is symmetrical, except for the fact that a man can have a secondary wife and a woman can't have a secondary husband. Though even that is a little complicated. If I've got it correctly, a woman whose husband is sterile, I think, can get pregnant by another man as sort of an official, legitimate kind of activity. But other than that, you don't have it. But in terms of the marriage rights, it seems to be symmetrical. But it might be that, you know, that 1% of the marriages are marriages on woman's portion, and 2% are marriages on joint contribution, and 97%. But the other thing is that it isn't just land. That in terms of the division of the marriage, it's one of the things that's puzzling about all of this stuff, in a sense, is that you have descriptions of rules which don't sound like very bright line rules. So if you say it's a marriage on equal contribution, does that mean exactly equal? What if he contributed the land and she contributed the cattle? And there are a lot of other things like that. I mean, I'm just giving that as one example. The whole business of the category of a big farmer versus a small farmer. It matters legally, because what your honor price is determined by which of those it is. It seems to affect the terms of your contract if you're the client of a lord. And yet, what do you have? You have sort of impossibly exact descriptions. A large farmer will have a house of this size and this number of cattle and this number of sheep and this number of that. It's hard to believe that really describes it. So I don't know if it's just that in practice somehow there is a, you know, communal consensus on who's a large farmer and who's a small farmer, or about how much it takes, or if there are much more detailed rules that we're not seeing about how you add up land and cattle and everything else to decide how rich you are. So there's a lot of stuff in here, which leaves me sort of feeling as though they're only telling me a third of the story. A different issue, one of them, which is you've got these stages at which I'm making a claim against you, and ultimately, if the claim is never answered, I end up confiscating your cattle or some of your cattle. But at any stage, you can agree to arbitration. What counts as an agreement to arbitration? Does agreement to arbitration mean that that there are a set of recognized judges, because it's pretty clear that judge and lawyer are sort of professions? Does it mean if you agree to any judge in the two-off that then it goes to that and he decides? Or does it mean if you agree to decision by the king's judge? I can't tell. And as I say, it clearly was a functional system. It was working. So there must have been answers to all these questions. But again, what we have are somewhat fragmentary legal texts written down something like 600 years later, that is, copy is made 600 years after the things were originally written, with commentary during that 600 years by people who may or may not have understood the text trying to explain it. Our dating of the original text is somewhat uncertain. That one of the things that's pretty clearly going on is that they're trying to date the original material on linguistic grounds. That the language is changing over time, and we've got some evidence of that. So if you've got a chunk of a legal text which is in Irish as it was in the early 8th century, you say that, but we aren't even sure about that because some of the stuff may have been deliberately archaic. You may have had somebody's writing his treatise, he wants this rule to sound impressive. He's read the old stuff too. He's probably read more of it than we have because it hasn't survived. So he writes it in the style of the old stuff, and then we're fooled into thinking it's old. So the line I was using for a while, and I think is probably still justified, is that Jewish law is the best documented legal system in the history of the world, and Irish law the worst. Which is probably an exaggeration because there are things we don't know anything at all about. But there's sort of this frustrating picture of a partial picture of what seems to have been a very elaborate and sophisticated system. In addition to which, it's not as if there was a legislature for the island. There was no common ruler. As far as we can tell, by the time the legal treatises were written, there were provincial kings who had quite a lot of authority. So there were maybe four or five, something like that, kings in Ireland. There was from time to time somebody who claimed the title of High King. But it doesn't look as though there was really anybody who ever really ruled the whole island. And so... what presumably is going on with these legal treaties is that some person who considers himself or is considered an expert on the law is writing down what he thinks the law is. Well, maybe that's what the law is all over Ireland. Maybe that's what the law is in his province. Maybe that's what the law is in his two-off. Maybe that's what he believes the proper law is, even though all these fools aren't following. You don't know, right? So it's neat stuff, and it's a fascinating system. But I mean, one of the things that struck me looking at the whole business on procedure is you've got this elaborate story of the five paths of procedure. As far as I know, it's coming from a single source, from two different texts of a single source. So, and the rest of the, I don't think the other sources are describing it that way. It sounded from at least some of the other stuff I was reading as though a contract would have both Nadim sureties and Roth sureties, whereas the five paths seem the same. We follow this path, you have a Nadim surety, and that path, you have a Roth surety, and that path, you have a pledge, and so forth. Similarly, there's this elaborate picture of a court where the court has got a king and a bishop and a chief poet and these people are sitting here and these people are sitting here and all of it. It can't describe how all cases were decided because there can't be, kings and chief poets can't get involved in every dispute over somebody claiming that this piece of land is mine and not yours or that they can't have divided up the land wrong or something. But I don't know if it's described as something that never occurred, and the author was saying this is the way a proper court ought to be, or whether it's describing what happens when you're in the court of a provincial king settling a dispute between two of the two-off kings. I just don't think I know enough. Now, a different interesting issue, it's not the same point, but one of the things which I guess I mentioned briefly in the chapter, it was sort of interesting reading the scholars on this, is that some of the people argue that what we're getting are remnants of a much older legal system. That, as you probably know, there is a family of languages which runs from Sanskrit to Gaelic, geographically speaking, which includes most of the languages we're familiar with other than the Oriental ones, called the Indo-European languages. All right, that's English. All of the Romance languages are Indo-European. Persian is Indo-European. Sanskrit is Indo-European. Arabic and Hebrew are not. Hungarian is not, Finnish is not, Basque is not. So there are sort of pockets of non-Indo-European languages here in India. But most of that area is in Turkic languages. Turkish or not, is not. And the presumption is that at some point you had some people who were the Indo-European speaking the original Indo-European language, and all the rest are descended from them. Now, you don't know whether the descent is biological or cultural. You know, it could be that you had a bunch of good conquerors who were Indo-Europeans, and they conquered places where they were 2% of the population, but they imposed their language. We don't know. And I'm not sure there are theories of this stuff. But the idea is that the Irish legal material shows some things that also show up in the Indian legal material. And that raises the interesting conjecture that maybe some of what we're getting is Indo-European law extinct for 3,000 years or something. I don't know how far back they figure the Indo-European language is split, but it was a long time ago, pre-Roman, say. Which takes it to almost 3,000 years ago. So that's one of the sort of intriguing ideas, that you've got these sort of neat, interesting systems, and I've seen at least the argument that you have a transition at some point which shows up in the language between kings and great kings. That kings are something like the Tuath king, that is the king of a few thousand people, and that then they encounter, I don't know, the Persian Empire, or one which I think was the first really big empire that we know about, or other things, and the language starts getting in words for big kings, as it were. So I don't think we know enough, but that's also part of the fun of it, is trying to guess what's really going on, and it's clear that the scholars themselves differ. That Binchy, who's, I think, my favorite of these people, just the one I most enjoyed reading, is the one who's arguing for the Indo-European origin of some of it. But I also like him because he's the one who makes the point that we sort of take it for granted that a working legal system has to be sort of something like what we're used to. And that the evidence of lots of primitive systems is that at least in primitive small societies, you can have functional systems where there is no sovereign enforcing the law, where the law is a set of customary law and mechanisms by which people settle their disputes. And that's also intriguing. I think I told you about the bit of Binchy, which I actually think I quoted on my blog at one point, where he's referring to two other scholars, one of whom argues that Ireland had no curial law, had no law imposed by superior authority, and therefore must have been complete chaos of, you know, might make right all the time. And the other of whom argues Ireland clearly was not complete chaos, therefore it must have been the kings were enforcing the law. And Binchy's comment is both of these people are arguing from the same unstated premise, which is that only the system of late Victorian England, where they grew up, that's the way he puts it, can successfully enforce law, namely a superior authority enforcing it all. Whereas the lesson of looking at primitive societies is that you can, in fact, get law enforcement without that kind of system. Yeah.
So let's say we have a contract and you breached it, and I come to your house and I say, you know, you breached my contract, and then I come back the second time. And then the third time I come back and I start taking your account.
Notice that you've got witnesses through all of this. All of this is an elaborate ceremonial procedure. You are coming on my property. I probably ought to put it into the chapter because it was sort of dramatic from one of the sources. It's like you're coming on the chapter on my property with two horses and four cattle or something, and the following set of witnesses, and saying the following words, and then going off again. And then you're waiting a certain number of days and then repeating it with, I think, if I remember correctly, more of your animals. And I think it's after the third time, still having not gotten the response from you, that I then go take your cattle, put them onto a prepared place, either on my land or on someone else who's given me permission, and make more ceremonial statements, and then a few days later they start forfeiting.
Let's talk to someone who's slightly more powerful to prevent you from taking their cattle, and who's going to enforce that? Is it
well,
the king?
Not that we know of. Not that we don't know. But one possible answer is that all of this is coming out of a system where there were all of these sureties involved. So a bunch of the neighbors are already entangled in it. They saw the original contract. They can testify to what it was. And your native surety is obliged to use force to make you do things. So what I think may be going on, it's hard to be sure, but I think what may be going, that ultimately behind everything there's the threat of feud. But I think what may be going on is that the system is set up so that enough of the people in the not very large community are involved with the case, so that everybody will know you're in the wrong. Go back to the Roman Child Gypsy case. Think of this as a better organized version of the Roman Child Gypsies. You say, I don't owe you that land. I say, wait a minute, here's my native surety, or you're one of my native sureties who is a witness to the case, and he will testify that you agreed to it. And furthermore, you say you paid me the money? Wait a minute. Here's the other, the native surety on the other side, whose job it was to make sure that once you paid the money, I didn't keep claiming it. Did you pay me the money? No, he didn't pay you the money. I mean, that, I think something like that is going on, and that there's, and the thing is, you've got a whole network of relationships going on here, because we may be clients of lords or of the same lord. We may or may not be kinsmen of each other. Your kin group is going to be reluctant to back you if you're doing things that are wrong, because they're eventually going to get into trouble, whereas my kin group will be more likely. I mean, I don't know. But it looks to me as though you've got this whole sort of slow ceremonial process to avoid my just coming up and saying, all right, you owe me the money, I'm grabbing your cattle and going away. And you've got this whole business with sureties, which is entangling other people in the original contract. Now, presumably for small contracts, my guess is they don't go through all of that. And that may be just as simple as reputation, but that for anything serious, I think they do. I think that's what's happening, but I don't want to claim that I know. Yeah.
In the Bible, there's a couple of scriptures that talk about, punishment, criminal or civil, done based on the testimony of witnesses. Was that society, the Jewish society, functioning as sort of this ceremonial based thing? Or
The Jewish society, by the time we really know about it, you do have a court system.
Right.
You've got the judges and the Sanhedrin. And actually, there's one of my colleagues in Chicago, Jeff Miller, who wrote stuff trying to make sense of early Israeli law. And I probably read that 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I no longer remember how he interpreted what was going on. But I'm sure there's some stuff in common. That is that oaths are and seem to be involved in all of these systems. We know that oaths are involved in rabbinic law, in the Jewish law, at the point when we can observe it. Oaths show up in Islamic law. They show up in Cheyenne law. And they show up in the Irish law. The weird part of the Irish law is the whole business about honor price. Because if I correctly understand what they're saying, if I swear that I saw you steal that cow, and he swears that he didn't, that he was watching and you didn't steal the cow, if his honor price is higher than mine, he wins. If it's lower, I win. And one of the things I haven't figured out is whether you can add up honor prices. Because there's a procedure by which a second person can swear along with you. And at least nothing I've seen here says whether we then get the summed honor price or not. My guess is not, and the reason my guess is not, is that you've got these repeated comments about the danger of contracting with somebody of high status. That it's dangerous to lend money to a king, or even to a lord. Because when you come to collect, he'll overswear you. If all I need is have two or three friends swear with me, then he can't. And that's interesting, incidentally. That the part I find very neat about it from a law and econ standpoint is that we tend to think, let me go to a different. Let's take the idea as late as the 19th century of women having limited, in our culture, of women having limited contractual rights to protect them, right? Yes, in one sense, it's protecting them in that I can never sue you because you couldn't have made a binding contract agreeing to pay me. But it also means you can't make that contract in the first place. And, similarly in other cases, so that it's unclear. Suppose, to take a different case, suppose that you're a judge in our society and you say, I really like poor people. So anytime a landlord tries to evict a poor tenant, I'll rule in favor of the tenant. At first glance, you're helping poor people. But of course, once it becomes obvious you're doing that, nobody near you is going to rent apartments to poor people, and therefore you've made them worse off, not better off. So that the whole thing in which being known to have superior legal rights sometimes gives you lower rights. On the other hand, pretty clearly there are contexts where you're going to have to contract with somebody higher than you are, in particular lord-client contracts, where the Lord is an enemy, he has a higher honor price than the client. And I don't know. I mean, there's this business of fasting against people, which I also don't understand very well. But there's got to be some way in which I can enforce that contract, and I don't know how I do it. Because he can overswear me. Maybe the answer is just he's not willing to swear things that aren't true. Because I think there is something, I believe in this as there is in the Jewish law, that if you've sworn an oath and it's turned out to be not true, I think you can't swear again on other things. I'm not sure. So maybe what's going on is that if my Lord overswears me in some dispute about our contract agreement and other people observe that it isn't true, then in some future case they can get him to not count. But I don't know. Yes? What? Yeah, sure. That's right.
Yeah.
That's the obvious problem. My point is only that you may not do it all the time. My point is only that the particular contract between a lord and a client is always with somebody of higher status than you are if you're the client, and therefore you're going to be vulnerable to overswearing. But there's a lot of the stuff I don't understand. So you know, it's got to have been a workable system. That's sort of all of these things. The one thing we know is that they can't be as bad as we first sometimes think they are, or they wouldn't have lasted for hundreds of years, as all of these did. Yeah.
Because I think that like the swearing in the witnesses,
yes,
first come in like in the Old Testament, and then,
yes,
in the New, you have like reference to, well, try to work. The people are told, like, try to work it out on your own first through the witness and the,
yes,
oath thing, and then and only then go take it to the judges. So I'm wondering,
yes,
if it's...
But by the New Testament, are the judges Jewish judges or are they Roman judges? Israel is under
know.
Roman rule.
I think
rule,
that there
I don't
was
know.
Like a dual system that,
yep,
the people like function under. So
yep.
I don't know.
Yep, that may well be.
But I would be interested in reading your friend, your colleague.
Yes,
today.
Jeff Miller is the person. I have no idea where he published it. This is something that I read, I say, more than 20 years ago when I was at Chicago, which is where he was at the time. I think he's now in New York, if I remember correctly. But if you could probably do a web search and you might find, because it was on, I think it was a Law and Econ discussion of Old Testament law, something like that, or law of Israel in the time of the Old Testament. And that would be interesting to try to make sense of. Yeah, I mean, part of what intrigues me is not, I mean, the scholars are talking about similarities between Indian and Irish, and those are both Indo-European, but the Somali aren't Indo-European. And what do we have? Well, in the Somali, one of the kinship groups that's responsible for some things is four generations in agnatic kinship. Not all of it, it's more complicated than that, but that's sort of one of the underlying lumps in that system of coalitions. In the Irish, the group that's responsible for helping you with your feuds is the Dairbhín, which is four generations. In Irish law, when you injure somebody, you owe him sick maintenance, which doesn't, I don't know, it sounds like a sort of a screwy idea, because I'm not sure I really want to be in the house of the guy who injured me. But maybe the theory is, especially if it's an unintentional injury, that lets him prove that he wasn't really intentional and, you know, make friends, I don't know. In Somali law, you've got a version of sick maintenance, not all the same details. And so, it's sort of hard to figure out whether what we're observing are simply sort of things that naturally worked in similar societies, because the Irish are largely cattle herders, although they're also farmers. The Somali are mostly camel herders, so they're doing some farming. They're fairly small population groups and so forth. So I don't know what's going on. But I know pieces of what's going on. That's I think about the best we can do. And the part of it that interests me is how much of it looks as though it's showing a non-curial system, how much of it looks as though it's mechanisms at which you're never going to the king. Now, maybe, if we go back to this question of restraint, maybe the restraint is coming after the king's giving you a judgment. You know, that's conceivable. Maybe you went to that elaborate court system, the king said, yes, he owes you, and then you did the private restraint. Because that's, in a way, if you think about the Icelandic system, there's no king. But the Icelandic system, there's a formal court system, and after it gives its verdict, it's up to you to enforce them. And we even saw some of that in the Greek, in the Athenian case, where the court has given its verdict, the land is yours, you're entitled to push him off it. Are we going to push him off it? No, it's your job to push him off it. And one presumes that in that case, the knowledge that the court, that the court had supported you is going to make it easier for you to push him off it. This, a lot of this goes back to a point I think I may have made before, which is that the crucial requirement for a feud system is some mechanism such that the right makes might. Some way in which when you're in the right, you're more likely to win the fight than when you're in the wrong. And I suspect that in the Athenian case, everybody, including the neighbors, knowing that he's been judged not to hold the land, means they won't back him, and probably your friends will back you. And probably if he hurts you in resisting, maybe he's going to get into further legal trouble. That wasn't true in the sagas. That's probably true here, too, I would guess. And in the Irish one, my guess is that part of the whole system of sureties is right makes might, because after all, with the surety system happening, when you refuse to pay back the money, there is your native surety who you agreed to in advance, who maybe you agreed to, maybe one of the reasons we agreed to him was he's somebody with power over you. Maybe he's, you know, the leading figure in your kin group. Maybe he's your lord, and he's going to help me force you to pay up. But as I say, I don't want to be too confident about any of this stuff. I wish I understood it better. But as I may have mentioned, I had a particular question about the sort of the private law, public law, where I emailed Kelly, who's the author of the book we're reading, and his answer is, I don't know either. Which sort of made me feel at least I wasn't missing anything too obvious. And I've now read a bunch of other people. I don't know of anything else equivalent to his book. I don't know of anybody else of the modern scholars who has sort of put it all together. But there's a book which I have read called, I think, The Path to Judgment, which is partly about Irish and partly about Welsh law, because there are a lot of parallelisms. You often get closely related words across Irish and Welsh. They're both they're both versions of Gaelic, although they are different versions of Gaelic. I believe that Welsh is what's called Brythonic, and Irish is what's called Goidelic. So there are two divisions, two large divisions. And then I think Cornish and Breton are also Brythonic, and I think Scots Gaelic is also Goidelic, if I've got it right. But they're similar enough, and you can certainly, there are places where you can see what look like the same initial institutions but then developing in somewhat different ways in the different countries, so that's why they talk about both of them. One of the things I didn't put in the chapter, and maybe I should have, that she discusses, this is Robin Stacy, who I think is somebody I've actually corresponded with, and she's somebody at BTI, somebody else I knew pointed me at. And the road to judgment is the suretyship of God. That there are various contexts of both the Irish and the Welsh law in which God is your surety. And this might mean that if you don't fulfill your obligation, God is going to punish you. And you get that idea showing up in lots of these systems. That is, you get that in the Cheyenne law where you swear by the sun, and if you swore in falsehood, the sun's going to burn you up eventually. And you get the business in the Irish law that if a judge gives a false judgment, bad fortune will happen to the Tuath, will happen to the kingdom. So that's at least suggested. There are also suggestions that someone connected with the church is supposed to enforce the case of God as your surety. It's not quite clear who. There are references to, I forget what the term it is, but there's some category for somebody who seems to be like a hermit or a wandering holy man or something who in certain contexts is supposed to enforce things for you. And all of that is sort of unclear. And of course, one of the other complications is you've got the church there as well. That is, it's pretty clear, I think, that the underlying legal system we're looking at is the pre-Christian system. And it's then been modified in a bunch of ways because this stuff is being written several centuries after Irish goes Christian. And at the same time, you've got canon law as well as Graham law, which is the sort of traditional system. And unclear what you like better, so to speak. It turns out, something that I hadn't really appreciated, I was just rereading that part of the book, that you get essentially no capital punishment and no corporal punishment in the traditional legal system. It's true you can kill, if somebody has killed someone and doesn't pay the damage payment, you can kill him. But he's got the option of paying the damage payment. Whereas there seems to be a variety of places in canon law where you just kill somebody. That's the punishment. And similarly, I think there's flogging at some point in canon law, and there doesn't seem to be in the Irish law. But there are two systems existing at the same time. They're to some extent competing. The Brehon law has conceded a lot of status to the church, that a bishop has got a royal honor price. And there's some saying that the chief bishop is superior to the chief king because the king bows down before the church or something, kneels down before the church or something. I think he's got the same honor price, though, if I remember correctly. And then you've got poets who are running through this. The chief poet has a high honor price. And poets, I think the implication, if I read it correctly, is in the pre-Christian system, the poets were also sorcerers. That you've got people, and they may have also been entangled with the law people, but that if you look at the stories, the tames, which are sort of the Irish equivalent of sagas, and they're written down in Christian Ireland, but probably, I don't know there must be the same dispute there is in the Icelandic case, so I don't know about how old they really are, because they're describing events that are a good deal earlier. In particular, the warfare in the tames is largely chariot warfare. Which is typical of Bronze Age stuff, not of maybe early Iron Age, but not of 5th, 6th, 7th century, as far as we can tell. And that's important. And isn't happening at the time of that the law books are written down. But that's describing cases in which the Druids, who are, I think they're poets, and I think they're sorcerers, and I think they may also be judges, but I'm not sure about that, have an important role, and in the tames, they're sometimes doing magic of one sort or another. So anyway, my guess is that probably people still believe in some of the magic even after Christianity comes in, whether or not they're supposed to. And there's, as in Iceland, there's sort of this really interesting tension between the church trying to get people to follow its rule and people not. Because one of the things that got quoted, I think maybe by Kelly or somewhere else, is the question of polygyny. That the church thinks that you should only have one wife. And you've got one of the Irish writers saying, but look, in the Old Testament, the Israelites were the people who God loved. You know, David had multiple wives. All these important people had multiple wives. How can you be telling us that it's wrong? It's our custom anyway. And it's pretty clear that priests could be married. And I'm not sure at what point. I think that's true in early Christianity in general, as far as I can tell. And I'm not sure at what point you start shutting down on that, or what the reasons are. But, yeah.
The reasons had to do with land ownership. They didn't want the families of the priests to inherit the land that the church was on, was becoming more powerful than.
Yeah, that's certainly a possible explanation. Yeah. What's happening in Iceland is that the priest is essentially under the control of the donor who gave the land the church is on, and therefore you're getting a sort of de facto tax system coming out of tithes. That's one of the possible explanations for the increasing centralization of power by the 13th century in Iceland, that you finally had a tax revenue to support people building up large coalitions. Yeah.
Been interested for some time in sort of that transition from like the church, the early Christian church, like from magic to nomad, like to magic.
Yes.
Do you have like a source
from
that or
on magic?
Mm-hmm. Like when that transition happened from where you have
from druids to priests,
right?
No, there probably is stuff, but
okay.
It's not something that I've really looked at. But similarly, you don't have monogamy monogamy of ordinary people in the early Christian. That is, it's pretty clear, I think, if you go back to the Merovingians, that for people who aren't historian types, Charlemagne is 800 AD. It's an easy date. Charlemagne is crowned Holy Roman Emperor in Rome in 800 AD. So that's a nice point to sort of stick in your calendar to figure things out. Charlemagne is the first of the Carolingian dynasty. And his father and grandfather, I think that's right. Maybe his father and grandfather count as Carolingian. It's named after him, so I think he starts. But in any case, at least before his grandfather, and I think his grandfather, you've got Merovingians, who are a previous Frankish dynasty. Franks are a Germanic people, even though we get the French out of them, and they conquered Gaul, which is why the French speak French instead of German, because Gaul had been Roman for a long time, and they spoke Latin. Of course, originally they spoke a Celtic language. It's even more complicated that the Gallic was a Celtic language, I think probably a Brythonic one. They're conquered by the Romans by Caesar in the first century BC, so that means that by the time the Roman Empire falls, they've been Roman for 500 years, so they're all speaking Latin. Then they're conquered by the Franks, and this time, instead of the conquerors imposing the language, the conquered impose the language, and so they end up with a Romance language. Yeah.
So when Normans conquer Ireland,
yes.
Are they French-speaking people?
Speaking Norman French, almost certainly, yeah. The assertion I've seen is that John was the first English monarch, that is, the first Norman English monarch to speak English. And so the conquest of Ireland is a little before that. The way I'm tying it together is by people. The critical step in the conquest of Ireland is that Dermot of Leinster, the king of Leinster, one of the provincial kings, gets thrown out by his population, by his enemies within his own province. And he goes to England and makes a deal with Strongbow, who is the Earl of Pembroke, who's a major Norman baron. And Strongbow and his friends bring in an army. And at some point, Henry II, who's the king, is worried that they're going to establish an independent kingdom in Ireland. So he takes over the project and brings in a bigger army and conquers Ireland, essentially. So that all of that is happening roughly in the time of Henry II. And John is the younger son of Henry II. Richard Lionheart is the elder son. So therefore, all of this is a little before John. And assuming the story is true, which I think it may well be, that the Norman kings before him were speaking Norman French. And of course, English as a language is only developing at this point anyway, because Anglo-Saxon would have been what the previous dynasties had spoken. And English is something that develops out of Anglo-Saxon with sizable influence from French and, I guess, other languages, but especially French. And of course, English has ended up now as sort of the looter of the world's languages. There's some great quote that somebody uses online that, you know, English doesn't just borrow other people's words. It knocks out other languages and rifles their pockets going through for material. But anyway, so I think the people who initially conquered it would have been Norman barons. But my impression is that over time they get Irishized very largely. I'm not sure about language, but the impression one gets is that you're sort of getting reconquests later at a point at which the descendants of the Norman barons have really largely gone native, as it were. And if you look at this, I think some of the stuff that Kelly is quoting, where people in the 16th century or so are complaining about how these English people, about how the Irish are doing stuff by Irish law instead of by English law. All right, well, the Irish by this time have been under Norman rule for 300 years or so. But it's not clear how much it really took. And then you've got, I think in the time of Cromwell, there's a fairly major reconquest of Ireland with lots of people killed, which makes Cromwell rather unpopular with the Irish to this day. And I think under Elizabeth, I think there's also got some of that same stuff going on. So you've got, I think, some element of what's supposed to happen in China, where the Chinese get conquered by the Mongols, and in a couple of generations, the Mongols are all Chinese, and they get conquered by the Manchu, and a couple of generations of Manchu are all Chinese, and so forth. But anyway, let's see. Other things that occur to people? Because there's certainly stuff I can... One of the points, which I don't remember if Kelly discusses, almost certainly not in what you have, is the way this kin group stuff is working out for royal kin. Because the kin group is, in a sense... orthogonal to the class system. Now, not entirely. I don't believe that slaves would be part of the kin group at all, as far as I can tell, except insofar as they were related to the kin group or their owner. But that with the royal kin, you don't have primogeniture, that in fact it looks as though kings are usually not succeeded by their sons. And a suggestion that at least one author makes of what's going on is that being a king is a fairly high-risk profession because there's a good deal of internal warfare. And that therefore, you want to have the heir determined in advance. You don't want to have fight over it when the king dies. So the king wants to appoint a tanist, which was the term for the pre-chosen royal heir, and you want the tanist to himself be an adult. Well, the king has become king at 27. If he has any kids, they're small kids at this point. So he appoints his cousin or his nephew or some close relative who is an adult and can play a major role and can take over if he gets killed as his tanist. And the requirement seems to have been that to be eligible, you had to be within a certain number of generations of a king. So I don't remember what it was, but like maybe your grandfather or your great-grandfather had to be a king. And you get the pattern in some of these kin groups where you've got two branches of the kin group because at some point somebody has two sons, both of whom have surviving descendants. And they trade off who's king. And presumably part of the reason is that if one of them holds the throne for several generations, the other is no longer eligible. And they really don't, the other one doesn't really want that to happen, and so they're willing to let both of them stay in the game, at least for a noticeable period of time. But that was sort of intriguing. Yo?
I wonder if the system where what that kind of
primogeniture.
Asking if there's kind of like terms, you know, so I'll be king for 10 years. That should prevent.
It was normally, I think it was lifetime, except that there were various injuries which disqualified you. That I think at least, now, how much this is enforced one doesn't, there's a bunch of stuff you don't know whether it's enforced, but at least in theory, I think a king has to be whole. So I believe that if a man is blinded in one eye, I think he can't be king anymore, or, you know, crippled or that sort of thing. And just how far that goes, I don't know, but I think there's at least one case where a man is blinded or partly blinded by someone's bees and ceases to be king and then sues the bee owner for the fact that he lost being king as a result. I think that's one of the cases mentioned.
I was wondering because it seems like a good way to get rid of assassins and assassins.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't at least remember noticing any references in the sources, and I may be wrong, to kings in advance becoming unking, so to speak. That is advancing they would. I assume you could resign. That's certainly true in many systems. My memory is that one of the things you get in Byzantine history is that when an emperor is being overthrown, sometimes what you do is to blind him, and he can then continue his life, you know, in a monastery or something. But he now isn't qualified to be emperor, so there's no danger of his being reestablished. And I think, I'm not sure if it's in the business. I think there's some context for castration used in the same way. That is something that doesn't kill somebody, but makes him no longer the kind of person here who's allowed to be the ruler. Yeah.
So it kind of strikes me as suspect that the king has this chief poet. And I'm wondering if you think that maybe the chief poet really served as kind of like a propagandist for the king.
Later on, there's a discussion in one of the things I read, which is talking about the poets considerably later in history, where basically you have families. Being the poet runs in a family. It's a more or less inherited profession. You have schools where poets are trained. And the poet basically has the job of writing poems on appropriate occasions. So if his patron is getting married, he's got to write a poem for it. If his patron's daughter is getting married, I don't remember what all the cases are, I'm not sure they said, but it was pretty clear that it was seen in that sense, at least for some of the poets, as really being a job with an obligation. So yeah, propagandist is plausible enough and if you go to the Norse case, where a king of Norway is going to have skalds at his court. And that's what they're recognized as. They're generally warriors as well, typically. And part of the job of the skald, presumably, is to give ward fame to his patron. He writes poems. And the comment that Snorri Sturluson is Icelander in the 13th century. He's one of the major players in the civil war conflicts that finally end the Icelandic system. But he's also an important literary figure. He's known to be the author of Heimskringla, which is a saga history of the kings of Norway. He is the author of the Younger Edda, which is a poet's handbook, and which is a major source for Norse mythology because a lot of the stuff in it is explaining bits of the myth that are used as verse references. And he may be the author of Egilsaga, which is my favorite saga, though we aren't sure. And one of the fun things in Heimskringla is that the introduction to Heimskringla by Snorri, written in the 13th century, is a discussion of sources. How do we find out what happened in the past? And his conclusion is that the most reliable sources of the information are skaldic poems written at the time. And the argument is that the skaldic poem is very stable in transmission because it's a tight verse form, so you can't change a word by accident without having the poem no longer work. And that since the poem was composed and presented in the presence of people who had been present at the events, that if your king had lost a battle, pretending he had won it would be mockery. So that if your king lost a battle, you praise how bravely he fought in, you know, against these desperate odds and lost. But you've got to get the facts right because your audience knew the facts. That's at least Snorri's account. Now, Snorri also, interestingly enough, explains the Norse religion. He's, of course, Christian. This is 13th century. And he has a theory about who Odin was. That Odin, if I remember correctly, he thinks was a magician who, with his family, as it were, migrates in at some point and then ends up getting credited as being a god. So that what I found fun, in a way, is that if you didn't know what it was and you were just reading it, you would have guessed maybe that this is written by the modern historian explaining it. And this is a guy in the 13th century trying to figure out how you figure out what happened in the past because he's going to be writing a history of the kings of Norway, which he writes. So. And
poets were kind of like, they served a historical function.
Well, that's how he's using them. I don't know whether they thought of it that way or not. They might have. But at least in the short term, they did. In the short term, Egil, one of the neat parts in the Egil saga is where he buys his head with a poem. He basically is in a situation where a man who has good reason to hate him wants to kill him and has the ability to do so, but also would like an excuse not to because of the internal politics within his own group. And so Egil, who is a famous poet as well as a ferociously dangerous fighter, composes a poem in the honor of his enemy and recites that as the ransom for his head, and it's accepted. And I gather, I don't read Old Norse, but I gather from the comments that the poem itself is a little bit ambiguous, that there are parts of it which you can read as not really praising Eric Bledax at all.
Almost like sarcasm.
It was common to say of a man in Norway that he was so famous that he was spoken of in the West, meaning in Iceland and in the islands and the Orkneys and such. It's not clear what it means to say that Eric is so famous that he's spoken of in the East. It is common to praise a man for holding his lands. It's not clear whether you praise a man for holding his lands when everybody knows that his brothers drove him out of Norway, whether that's praise or mockery. And given everything you can see about Egil's personality, he is the kind of person who would push as close to the line as he thought he could get away with. Right? He's not a nice man. He's an impressive man. He makes a wonderful literary character, but you don't really want him as a neighbor. He kills his first person when he's 10 or 11, something like that. Other things, going back to the king groups for a moment, the one that gets most of the attention here is the Derbthene, which is the four-generation one. But they have defined kin groups of other sizes, as it were. And one of the issues that arises is what happens if the Derbthene goes extinct. Because, you know, on the one hand, you say, well, you know, a man has two sons, they have two sons, but the population is staying roughly stable. So, in fact, the average person having one child who might be a daughter and will marry away might be a son. It's not all that unlikely that at some point there are no male descendants, or maybe no descendants at all from from the fourth generation, from the great-grandfather. And then I think what happens is that the descendants of the great-great-grandfather get to redistribute the land among themselves. I believe that's what's going on, so that they're using kinship sort of in multiple areas. I'm not sure that's right, but I think that's right. The kinship also, another respect in which it's not just the Derbthene, is that the rules for killing somebody are more complicated, in some ways more interesting, than the Icelandic or the Islamic rules. Because in both of those systems, there's a fixed fine which goes to the heirs of the victim. In the Irish system, there is a fixed fine which seems to be the same for everybody, or at least for all free men, which goes, I'm not sure it goes to the kin group somehow, but I'm not sure if it's to the heirs of the victim or not. But then there's an additional set of fines which appear to be for the fact that you have insulted the honor of all the kin of the people you killed. So you owe the brother of the man you killed, I think, half his honor price. You owe the father and not the son. I think all of those get half honor price. You owe his cousin maybe, not the man's honor price, the brother's honor price. You owe the cousin maybe a quarter of his honor price. You owe the foster father or foster brother, I think, an eighth of his honor price.
And this kinship is not limited to agnatic kinship. It's not limited to male line kinship. You owe his maternal cousins some amount as well. So you can see it'd be quite expensive to kill someone, especially if he was high enough status so that his relatives all had high honor prices. And I think, I'd have to look more carefully, but I think that if you look at it, those payments probably add up to more than the wear guild for the man himself. Though I'm not sure if that's right.
So then they end up as a slave.
Or their kin pay the money.
Okay.
Or they get someone else to pay the money. The only actual case that's, at least that Kelly discusses, is this case that's in one of the saints' lives, where you've got a man who, under some unstated circumstances, kills somebody, and he can't afford to pay the damages, but he has a rich kinsman. And the rich kinsman pays the damages, and the man swears to serve the rich kinsman for the rest of his life. And I don't think he's a slave. I think he's a free man who just has sworn to do this. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a contractual obligation. And he eventually runs away to become a monk. And eventually, I think, confesses to the bishop what he's done. And the bishop gives him a fancy sword and says, take this back to your kinsman and offer it as payment for releasing you from your obligation. But he won't accept it. Prophecy. And he goes and he offers the sword, and the kinsman doesn't accept it but agrees to release him from his obligation. However, at this point, the man has also defaulted from the obligation to support his parents because he ran away. So he now is obliged to stay and support his parents, but his father dies within the month, which I think the bishop also prophesied, and his younger brother agrees to take over the support of his mother, so he goes back to being a monk. So the result is that we're getting a little bit of an incident that goes through, as it were, a murder trial, so to speak. But we're getting it reflected in this saint's life, which is about the bishop whose monk he was, so to speak. So that I thought was sort of intriguing. Again, it gives you an idea of how fragmentary our information is. Other things? Other? Yeah.
I just had a question. You discussed how individuals, their rights wouldn't—they only had rights within their
most individuals,
area, except for poets and hermits. Yes,
that is the poets are the carryover of what was a very high status caste before. The poets are also noble, right? A poet, or most of the noble, as far as I can tell, are lords who have clients. That mostly it looks as though what makes you noble is that there are a certain number of freemen. I'm not sure if a lord could be a client of another lord, I don't know, but a certain number of freemen who have made this contract with you, where you are providing them typically with cattle, though I think it could also be with land, and they are then obliged to serve you in certain ways, to give you a certain amount of tribute in food, I think, and to host you a certain number of days during, I don't remember what the whole list is, and presumably to fight for you if you're involved in fighting. And if you have a certain number of them, you're a low-level lord. A larger number of them, you're a high-level lord. There are two different kinds of clients called free and unfree, although most of them are freemen, but it's a different contract, and basically the unfree contract looks as though it's the more favorable contract, but the one you can't readily get out of, whereas the free contract, the terms aren't as good as far as, particularly the unfree one, after a certain length of time, if I have it right, the cattle that the lord gave you become actually yours, rather than on loan for him, so to speak, which is not true for the free one. So you've got to have, like, I don't know, what is it, maybe four free and four unfree to be the lowest class of lord. But in addition, there are the other nemeds, the other lords, and poets are one of them. And there are some categories which are sort of on the edge. That is not in the case of the poet, the chief poet has the same honor price as the lord, as the king of Atuaf. So not as the provincial king, but quite a high honor price. And the ordinary poet, I think, counts roughly as a lord, if I've got it right. And I think things like blacksmiths maybe or some, I don't remember, there are some other categories which some sources seem to think are sort of semi-nem. There's a term which I forget, which is sort of means you're barely noble or half noble or something like that. I'm sorry, I've now forgotten your question.
After the hermits,
they're holy men of some sort. And I guess maybe they're wandering. Maybe they're people who go from one place to another and sort of are outside of the system and are thought of as in God's protection kind of thing. But there are a couple of other ways that you get enforcement across Tuas, and one of them is that the kings of two Tuas can make a treaty, and the treaty can provide that if one of my people kills one of your people's kin can conduct a feud against him to get payment. And it looks as though where you've got several kings under a single overking, then the one of them can in effect sue in the overking's court for an offense against his people by the other person's people. I think that's going on. So there are some mechanisms across, but mostly legal rights are within your own tuat. That's right. And one of the contexts where you end up with a marriage where the wife is entirely in control is if the husband is somebody who on his own has no rights in the tuat. So the husband is a foreigner, maybe somebody who was outlawed in his own tuat and fled to here, maybe he was somebody who was cast adrift, which is one punishment you sometimes get, and then came ashore here. So he really has no legal status on his own, but a woman is willing to marry him. He might be an important person. Maybe he got outlawed after killing six enemies or something, and, you know, good person to have in your having the family, so to speak. You might have enemies too. But then, if I've got it correctly, his honor price is based on hers, which is the reverse of the usual situation. She can cancel any contract he makes. I don't remember all the details, but that's more extreme, I think, than a marriage on wife's property. I think a marriage on wife's property, like a marriage on husband's property, one of them has some superior rights over the other, but it's not a huge difference. That I think that in general, I think either of them can cancel contracts that affect the household. Things like selling land or selling cattle, maybe. I don't remember the details. And I think that the one in the superior status maybe can cancel almost all contracts the other one can't. I'd have to go back and look at the details. It all gets very complicated and tangled. But again, I think it's the hermit is the one who's supposed to, in some sources, enforce a contract where God is your natum, where God is your surety. Because, and how he does it, I don't know. It's a very mixed bag of sources. I mean, as I guess it may be clear from Kelly, in addition to the legal stuff, we've got a bunch of other contemporary stuff. We've got the septads, which are, the Welsh have triads, and a triad is basically a verse which has three things. These are the three great kings, or something like that. And the septads, I guess, are doing it with seven. And, you know, these are the seven blows against which there's no legal recourse. I don't remember what they are, but they're a list of cases where you can hit somebody and they can't sue you. Or these are the... So you've got things like that, and you can try to figure out how they fit into the legal text. You may get it right or wrong. And then you've got the lives of various saints, and those are describing incidents that the saints are involved in that, for example, I think are almost our only source for describing what a duel was like is that I think St. Brendan, if I've got it correct, comes across two brothers who are both about to have a duel because they're disagreeing over the inheritance, and he magically makes their arms unable to move and then persuades them to reconcile and not to fight each other. So it's a little bit of a description of how the duel was set up initially. So we've got that kind of source. But we don't have the equivalent of Kelly's book, Pramana. We don't have something which tries to put out the, and maybe it existed. The Sanctus More, I think, is the collection of treatises out of which many, though not all of the surviving ones, came. Maybe if we had all of the Sanctus More, maybe we'd do it. But even that was presumably assembled by one person or one group of people somewhere, and so it might describe what things were like in one part of Ireland and not another, what they were like in a particular time and not another, and all the rest of it. Other things that struck people? Let me look at some of the other things that had struck me. Oh, yes.
I was told by the black context slaves here have no legal rights whatsoever. It's kind of close to American slavery again.
I think that's right. I don't remember any, at least. I think the master can kill a slave, though I'm not sure. Now, you've got unfree aren't all slaves. There are basically the top level unfree in terms of their legal category, if I have it right, are tenants at will who can leave as long as they pay back whatever they owe the the landlord, so to speak, but I think have no honor price of their own, which presumably is going to limit their ability to make contracts or swear oaths or whatever. Though they may have, it may be another case where while they're tenants, they bought half the honor price of the person they're tenant from, which is the usual dependent rule, I think. So they count as sort of the highest level of unfree, and then you go down to people who are essentially serfs, who are still not really slaves, but are bound to the land. And then you get the mug, I think, which is the term for a slave, and that's a full slave. And in fact, I don't know if it was mentioned in the stuff you read, but one of the terms for money is the worth of a female slave. That the penalty for this, or your honor price, is so many, whatever the word is, that was the word for female slave. Now, whether that actually meant that, or whether that it originally meant and now meant some number of cattle or whatever, one doesn't know. But that was sort of thought of as a standard. So, yeah, a lot of it is very, if you look at there's a treatise on marriage law which survived, only marriage is too narrow. It's basically all forms of sexual interaction, so that it includes rape, it includes letting two insane people have sex, and then who's responsible for the resulting children, and it includes ordinary marriages of a different categories according to the status, and ordinary marriages, different categories according to the consent of the kin. So that a man who visits a woman with the consent of her kin, but they're not living in the same household, they aren't married in the normal sense, who has what rights and obligations with regard to the children? What if it's without the consent of the kin and so forth? And it's actually, maybe that's the one which is done by the woman at VBI. I think she's the translator of that. And that one is partly interesting because you begin to understand how little we know if you try to read the literal translation and try to make sense of it, because it's very hard to do. At least I couldn't mostly read the discussion of what people think it means. Another interesting category, among the sureties, you've got at least three different categories of sureties, and maybe more than that. And the native surety is the person who sort of observes the contract, is supposed to remember it, and is supposed to enforce it. And there's presumably one on each side of the contract. You've got to enforce both parties to do what they're obliged to. The wraith surety is the person who agrees that if the contract is not fulfilled, he will be obliged to fulfill it. And he then, at that point, acquires a claim against the person who he's paid for, in effect. And I think he has to pay more than the original amount as sort of a penalty for it not being fulfilled, and he then collects still more than that, assuming he can collect it, which he may or may not be able to. And then there's the hostage surety, which is a somewhat odder one, because the hostage surety has agreed that if the contract isn't fulfilled, he will surrender himself to the other party as a hostage. And presumably, I guess if he never ransomed himself back, I guess the other party could kill him, I suppose, which doesn't have the impression that's what's supposed to happen. But what normally happens is after a certain length of time, he can ransom himself back, which requires that he pays both a fixed sum which represents the ransom. I'm not sure if that's the same amount as a weregoat for killing somebody. It might be, but somehow the value of a man, plus the debt that he's been a surety for, I think with some additional penalty for that. And he then, again, has a claim against the original person. And some of the sources seem to think that this was really in a political rather than a private context, that this was really the surety that one king was giving, one Tuath was giving to another Tuath. Because you certainly have talk about kings having hostages in their court. That's the only people where you seem to have references to hostages. And I think that when you have an over-king, I think the under-king gives him hostages as part of what's binding that contract. The over-king gives gifts to the under-king and is accepting them, somehow agreeing to be subject to the over-king. Which is, again, that's a little bit like the client-lord situation where the lord is providing some cattle or something to the client, which is also sort of, it's sort of odd because you've presumably also got the pattern of the gift economy where a lot of transactions are, I give you something, and you give, although you also have clearly exchange as well, and I give you something, and somehow in some of these cases the gift is symbolizing or setting up a relationship between people. But there's also the suggestion in some of the people's interpretation that some of these, in particular some version of the hostage surety, may have been what they refer to as a standing surety, meaning that rather than being appointed for a particular transaction, he is a surety for particular people. So it might be, for example, that there's some member of your kin group who has accepted the job that if anybody in the kin group is being sued, I will agree to be his hostage surety and get some compensation for that. And that's at least one interpretation of what's going on. Apparently there are two different words used for hostage surety. Itira is one, I forget what the other one is. And some people think they represented different versions of hostage sureties. And some people, I think that one of them is a hostage surety between somebody and someone of a different status, and one of them is an equal status. And so all of this is sort of different scholars, who all of whom know more about it than I do, who are trying to make plausible guesses of interpreting the evidence, and they could be wrong. And I discussed the general issue, which I thought was also interesting last time, of restrictions in contractual freedom due to interdependence. The fact that the son can't make a contract that might prevent him supporting his father cancels it. And that the son, I think, has some ability to cancel his father's contracts. I don't think it's as broad. And that if I've got it correct, if I want to make a contract which could actually impinge on the kin's land, for example, if I adopt somebody, which might mean one more person in the next generation with the land being divided up among, or if I want to sell some of the land, I need the consent of my kin to do it. And if I've got it right, there is a less close case where my default might make the kin liable for my damages, and where they can, when I make the contract, say we won't be liable for your damages. I think that's what's going on. So that, as it were, there's a sense, a different way of putting it, is that my kin are a sort of a default rate surety. That is to say, if I fail my contract, the normal assumption is that my kin will have to pay it, but they can back out of that when the contract is made. And that, in a way, fits the idea that if I kill somebody, my kin are likely to be the people who pay the damages if I can't, but they can choose not to, and then I get killed or enslaved, basically. One thing I didn't see, by the way, the assertion you see about a number of feud systems, I think it's true of some feud systems, is that A kills B, and B's kinsmen can then kill a kinsman of A if they can't get at A. And I think that's asserted about the Somali system, which mentioned that if it's from a different clan, you get to kill two for one. There are other contexts where it seems to be that if the original killer gets away, it's his kin's fault, and therefore you can punish them by killing one of them. I'm not seeing so far any of that in the Irish system. There doesn't seem to be any indirect liability killing. That it, if I understand it correctly, I think it's the case that if my kinsman kills somebody and all of us refuse to pay for him, our reputation may go down, but all that happens is that our kinsman gets killed or enslaved. I think. Fingers crossed. I could easily be wrong about that. One of the other things I was mentioning before, that among the things I don't know are what determines who's a legitimate judge or arbitrator. Another thing I don't know is who represents the kin. All right? If we say, I need the permission of the kin to do this, does that mean unanimous permission? Does that mean the senior member of the kindred? Have we elected somehow somebody who speaks for the kin? Because there are going to be some issues where the kin has got to decide. So that the business of the kin not being responsible for me, well, if the representative of the kin is present when I make the contract and doesn't say anything, then they're responsible. But who is the representative of the kin? And again, it's not clear to me how many people we're talking about, because, you know, four generations sounds like a lot, but of course the great-grandfather's dead by now. The grandfather is very likely dead by now, he may or may not be. So you may be talking about fathers and sons, and maybe I've only got one cousin, descended, or the father has got one brother, or maybe he's got a brother and a cousin. So my guess is that these Derbfina are not very large groups. And I'm not sure whether, that is, in the Somali system, pretty clearly if the Derbfina didn't have enough people to prosecute the feud, you just move a step or two up the tree and maybe bring in some other people as part of your contractual arrangements. It's not clear if that's happening in the Irish system or not, because you could see it would be a problem if you ended up having a feud and there's just, you know, two of you to prosecute it. Don't know. And part of the problem is that where we have detailed stories of conflicts, they're much earlier. They're the cattle raid of Cooley, which is the Queen Maeve and her husband going to attack the adjacent province on the grounds that they have one of the best oxen in Ireland, and the other province has the other best ox in Ireland, and they want to steal it. I think what's going on is that Maeve has the ox, and her husband wants to be equal to his wife, so he has to have the other greatest ox. But I'm not sure I've got that right. But in any case, so they go attack, and the problem is that the other province has a curse on them because of something that happened much earlier, such that when they are in most need, all of the warriors of that province will come down with the symptoms of childbirth, because of something they did to a semi-divine woman in a previous story. It's quite weird story. Basically, you have a man who marries a woman who is, I think, maybe of the sea. I don't want to say fairy, because that suggests the wrong image, but you've got a sort of elder race. Think of Tolkien elves, more or less, who show up in the early Irish stuff. And this is somebody who is, I think that's what she is, but she's something more than human. And she runs very, very fast. And her husband has foolishly boasted about how fast she runs. And at the point at which the king insists on testing it, she's pregnant. And so she outruns the horse and then dies. And speaks a curse dying, that in their greatest hour of need, they will all come down with what's just happened to her. And so the result is that the province is being invaded, and this great band of famous warriors, I think it's the Red Branch, remember, correctly, are all incapacitated. But Cuchulainn, who is on their side but somehow is not included in the curse, is still free, and he's the greatest hero in all Ireland. So he meets the invading army and has a series of single combats, killing one by one, and eventually, somehow or other, I don't remember why it is, but finally I think finally he stops being able to do that. Maybe he's wounded or something. But at that point, the curse ends, and so the invasion failed after all, because now the Red Branch comes and drives the invaders out again. But it's the Tain no Cooley, I think it's called. If you want to read stuff, it's an interesting story. Cuchulainn later ends up fighting his own son without knowing who it is and killing him, and then goes mad, and the druid, because they're afraid he's going to kill everybody, basically, sets him to fight the sea. And he fights the sea for 3 days, I think, and by that time his madness is over, if I remember correctly. So again, the druid is a magician of some sort in that story, very clearly. Let me think about some of the other... Oh, one of the things that I didn't mention and that wasn't in the part you read, but it's sort of interesting, and that's another category of nobleman, is the hospitaller. And what is a hospitaller? It is somebody who has accepted the obligation to give hospitality to all comers without limit. So he is presumably a wealthy freeman who is supposed to be living at the crossroads and has a ever-filled cauldron, an ever-open door, and has the status of a lord. And at one point they say that he ought to be at least twice as rich as a lord. At another point they talk about 100-fold wealth. So, but as long as he's willing to keep up this obligation, he gets the honor price of being a lord. So that I thought was sort of an intriguing and odd kind of system. And apparently exists right up to the 15th century, so there are references to people who are doing this. Something else that I didn't discuss, and I think maybe is mentioned in what you read, I'm not sure, though I think I mentioned it briefly in the chapter you read, is the idea of a pledge. And there again, I don't fully understand it. It sounds as though at the point when I come onto your land, one of the ways in which you can stop my seizing your cattle is to give a pledge, pledging that you will either repay the debt or agree to arbitration or something. And that freezes it. So that somehow it's giving a hostage for performance. But again, some of it is odd, because some of it is pledges given in advance, so that in some cases, I think maybe as a beekeeper, but you give a pledge in advance to your neighbors in case you should be doing something and did them an injury. And there are cases where both people are giving pledges to each other, and then, well, what's keeping each other from just seizing their person's pledge and going home? And maybe the answer is the pledge is of special value to you. Because some of the things mentioned as a pledge are a woman giving her needle, her sewing needle as a pledge, or maybe the warrior giving his sword or something. So there's some suggestion there that maybe it's an item especially valuable to you and therefore particularly useful as a physical hostage. But again, that part I don't really understand very well. And maybe somebody else does. So any other comments, sir? Go.
What you said about the hospital
Yeah.
Reminds me of and then the train. I think this is pretty common in the fiction, but there was an understanding that if you sailed into someone's port, then people there were supposed to be hospitable. So that eventually, when they go out to your place, the favor will be returned.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how that was.
But this wasn't mutual, because it was clear only a few people were hospitallers. You know, you've got a lot of friendship connections. You get guest friends in ancient Greece pretty clearly, so that if you're visiting another city, that's what you want to have. And you get the idea in Islamic tradition, or maybe it's originally Arabic tradition, of 3 days of the guest rite. That when once you've given somebody, I think, bread and salt or water, something like that, that then for 3 days he's under your protection, and you're obliged to protect him. There's a neat Kipling poem on this where you've got some idiot Englishman who's behaving very badly, and he ends up in, a Bedouin's tent, and the Bedouin is giving him 3 days protection, and he gets drunk and insults the Bedouin, and the Bedouin does nothing. 3 days are off, the Englishman goes off, Bedouin pursues him and kills him.
The hospitaller thing reminds me more of, they have like a practice in, I think it's in India or maybe some parts of Pakistan, where it's like the Sikh religion. Has this thing where they just allow everyone to come and eat, and they just prepare like massive amounts of food and bread, and everybody has to sit together and eat. And they also have like rooms for people that are like something on like cents on the dollar. And you can have room for 3 people for like 50 cents a night or something like that. So it seems like kind of something like that.
Well, certainly feeding people. I mean, I can take a much simpler case. The day before yesterday, I was in the office of one of my colleagues a bit down the hall, and he offered me a choice from a bag of candy bars that he had. And that's not just a matter of being hungry. It's because we sort of feel as though there's a kind of a social symbolism to feeding people. And I think that's true across, as far as I know, all cultures I know about. I actually used it in my first novel. I've got a point at which somebody offered, at which at the very beginning there's someone who is acting very paranoid, but you suspect with good justification. And the point at which she finally relaxes is when the stranger she's sitting next to offers her bread and salt. And so that's sort of the symbol that no, he's not going to kill her. Not that she has any reason to think he's going to kill her, it's just that there are other people who want to kill her and her friends, and she therefore is understandably nervous. That was sort of fun, trying to signal all of that without ever explaining it in terms of behavior. But anyway.